have enough time to do what we need to do. If you would, your notes should be on the table in front of you. Lesson 71, I've titled this lesson, Gabe Line, Schofield, and the Post-Niagara Landscape. So last Sunday, what we saw in Lesson 70 was we looked at and we studied about the decline of the Niagara Bible Conference. And we looked at how that testimony from 1875 till about 1900, we kind of closed out our discussion on that. And now today what we want to do is start looking at where did things go after that testimony closed. So if you look at the first point, introduction, bullet point number one, in the previous lesson we studied how the Niagara Bible Conference declined due to lack of leadership and doctrinal division. We saw how American millenarianism was divided over the timing of the rapture. So we saw how there was a rift within the Niagara Bible Conference. You had two things going on. Number one, you had the death of two of the biggest leaders within 3-4 years of each other, with Brooks and Gordon. And then within 10 years, virtually almost all of the rest of the men that were instrumental in founding of that died within 10 years of each other. And the second reason that led to the decline of the Niagara Bible Conference was the division over the issue of the timing of the rapture, which we talked about last time. So, in this lesson we want to consider what happened to American millenarianism after 1901, and the leaders, Arnold C. Gabelein and C.I. Schofield, who became the great champions for dispensational premillennialism in the United States. So the first point I want to talk to you about is the post-Niagara landscape, all right? The any moment coming controversy was evident in the pages of Our Hope as early as 1898, when W.J. Erdman, writing about St. Paul at Thessalonica, took a strong post-tribulation position. This is what he said: "It is therefore conclusive that Paul neither taught an immediate coming of the Lord, either for or with his saints, nor that he changed his mind." Now, it's important to understand a couple things. First of all, the journal Our Hope was started by Gabelein. Okay? So as early as 1898, there is already beginning to show up in print now this division between the pre-tribulationists and the post-tribulationists over the timing of the rapture. Erdman is going to be, he's a post-tribulationist. He changes his mind at some point, alright? Point number two, Gabelein, who established Our Hope in 1894, was quick to respond. He challenged Erdman's position, but his gentle and considerate style reflected his respect for Erdman and his willingness to discuss the issue as a matter of legitimate investigation. By late 1900, however, Gabelein's style and tone took an abrupt change. In a special December issue of Our Hope, devoted to Christ's premillennial advent, Gabelein included articles written by Schofield and Erdman and reprinted something from Truth by James H. Brooks. Schofield's article, entitled "May the Lord Come at Any Time," was strongly pre-tribulationist. Although his article did not touch on the controversy, Erdman was never invited to write for Our Hope again. So, the seeds, this argument, this controversy is now showing up in print, okay? And it shows up first on the pages of Our Hope. Our Hope is a periodical Bible study periodical, as I said, started by Gabelein in 1894, okay? 1898 now, 1900, things are starting to change. At first, Gabelein is very sort of respectful, sort of allows Erdman to share his views, what have you, but there comes a point where he's had enough and he's not going to allow him to write any more guest articles for Our Hope periodical, and that happens late in the year 1900. In February now, 1901, the next point, Gabelein made his point bluntly, and this is what he said: "No one can continue to give out a true scriptural edifying testimony of the coming of the Lord who believes that certain events must come to pass before the Lord comes, or that the church will pass through the tribulation." Gabelein had in effect excommunicated the post-tribulationalists and had begun to treat them as defectors from the grand old party. So, early 1901, February now 1901, in Our Hope, Gabelein is going to come out strong. And he's basically going to say that
that anybody that denies the pre-trib position is not giving clear, consistent testimony of the coming of the Lord and the events surrounding it.
So he's coming out, he's really sort of drawing a line in the sand here in the publication in February 1901, and he's saying that anybody that's teaching that the church will pass through all or part of the tribulation is not giving a true testimony, a true spiritual witness to the nature of the Lord's coming. And so he comes out in print, and if you remember back to last week, this is roughly the time where there began to be a hard break and division between these guys, where they realized that they could no longer cooperate with each other early in 1901. So the controversy apparently involved more than theology for both Cameron and Gabelein. Now, just to remind you that Cameron was the guy who, in his publication we saw last week, was coming out strong in favor of the post-trib position. So the controversy apparently involved more than theology for both Cameron and Gabelein, were running periodicals which claimed to be an apostolic succession from Brooks and Gordon. All right.
So, I know these points on the board here are kind of random, but I'm putting them up here somewhat for my own remembrance, but some for yourself. So Brooks and Gordon died. If my memory serves me correctly, Gordon dies in 1894, and Brooks dies in 1897. Okay? So what starts to happen is a paper war between Gabelein and Cameron over whose periodical is the rightful successor of these two men's ministries. Okay? Gabelein is with Our Hope, and Cameron is with,
I can't remember the name of it here. Where's it at? We'll come to it, and then I'll write it on the board because I know what's in here. So back to the last point on page one. The controversy apparently involved more than the theology for Cameron and Brooks. We're running periodicals which claim to be an apostolic succession from Brooks and Gordon. Cameron had stepped into Gordon's editorial position in 1895 with scarcely a break in cadence. So it's interesting. When Gordon dies, Cameron assumes editorial responsibility of Gordon's paper. Alright? Now, Cameron is not necessarily in 100% agreement with what Gordon was teaching. But when Gordon dies in 1894 and 1895, Cameron is to assume editorial responsibility of Gordon's periodical. So continue with that point. Cameron had negotiated with him about merging their two papers. Skipping too far ahead. Sorry, Cameron had stepped into Gordon's editorial position in 1895 with scarcely a break in cadence. During the last years of Brooks' life, Cameron had negotiated with him about merging their two papers. Nothing came of that, but when Brooks died, Cameron bought the magazine from the publisher, Fleming J. Revel. So
I'm trying to be clear with you. When Gordon dies, Cameron assumes editorial responsibility of Gordon's paper. Before Brooks dies, Cameron negotiates with Brooks to merge the papers together into one. It didn't happen. Okay? But after Brooks dies, Cameron purchases the rights to Brooks' paper from the publishing house Revel. Is everybody following that? Okay?
True. What is the name of the paper?
Yes. Thank you. Cameron had negotiated with him about merging, blah, blah, blah. We already got that. Nothing came out of it. But when Brooks died, Cameron bought the magazine from the publisher, Fleming J. Revel. Cameron could not have possibly carried out the editorial policies of both men in the same paper, since Gordon had been a historicist and Brooks a Darbyite dispensationalist. It is true, however, that both men had looked for the immediate advent of Christ. Yeah. A historicist is somebody that believes that we are currently living within the fulfillment of the book of Revelation. Okay? So they would believe that most historicists believe that we are somewhere between Revelation 16 and Revelation 19 within the fulfillment of the book of Revelation. So, the vast majority of Revelation has already been fulfilled in church history, Therefore, they call them the title historicist, because they view the majority of the book of Revelation as already having been fulfilled. The opposing view to that is futurism, which says that Revelation is either is that the majority of Revelation is awaits a future fulfillment, or the entire book of Revelation awaits a future fulfillment. So the historicists believe that we are living within some time between chapter 16 and chapter 19 of the book of Revelation. It's the easiest way I can explain it. If you want to know more about that, there are two lessons where I taught on it for 2 hours, the differences between them, back in other lessons that are available on the website. So meanwhile, Gabelin chose to ignore Cameron's legal claims as a successor of Brooks's paper, and represented his paper, Our Hope, as the true successor to the beliefs of Brooks and Gordon. According to Krauss, with Schofield's help, Gabelin secured the mailing lists of The Truth and advertised his magazine, Our Hope, as the doctrinal successor to it. He justified this by claiming that Cameron was not faithfully carrying on the prophetic witness of Brooks and Gordon.
So, Cameron technically owns the legal rights to Brooks' paper. Okay? But Gabelin says that Cameron is not faithfully continuing the testimony that these men had while they were still alive. So therefore, Gabelin ignores whatever legal claims that Cameron has in terms of ownership to the paper and paints his paper, Our Hope, as the doctrinal successor to the ministry of these two men. Is everybody following that? Okay. Now,
let me make sure I didn't miss anything here.
Schofield comes into play because Schofield allegedly helps Gabelin secure the mailing list from Brooks' paper. Now you say, well, why would that be the case? Well, we'll see in a little while that when Schofield gets saved, he's mentored by Brooks. So Schofield has a personal relationship with Brooks and with Brooks' family, okay? Because of the nature of his conversion to Christ and the fact that Schofield was directly mentored to Brooks. So these two men are arguing over who is the rightful successor to the ministries of these two men. Cameron has a legal claim. Gabelin is saying that it doesn't matter what the legal claim is. We are in line with these men in terms of the doctrine and the teaching. And Schofield allegedly helps secure the mailing list from Brooks' magazine for Gabelin for Our Hope. Everybody with this?
So, in May of 1902, Cameron began an eight-part series entitled To the Friends of Prophetic Truth, which so antagonized and alienated the pre-tribulationists that the breach was never healed. Cameron proceeded to explain how he had come first to accept and then later reject the doctrine of the secret rapture. Among other things, Cameron tried to claim that Gordon and Brooks had modified their views on the second coming at the end of their lives. Lastly, Cameron turned historian and claimed that the pre-tribulation rapture originated during a tongues meeting in Edward Irving's church. You guys that have been with the class, you remember that. We've gone over that and thoroughly debunked that. So, it's interesting though that in our day, Dave McPherson is not the first guy to make that charge. Cameron actually made it at the turn of the last century. So, according to Cameron, the pre-tribulationalists were accepting a doctrine first taught by a heretic, supported by lying spirits. So the idea that the pre-tribulation rapture originated in a tongues meeting in Edward Irving's church was not first put forth by Dave McPherson starting in the 1970s. The argument was first made by Cameron way back in the early 1900s. Now, again, for the sake of time, I'm not going to go over all that ground again. But if you want to know about that, Go to the website and watch the lessons. There's three lessons on called Darby on Trial, Debunking Attacks Against the Pre-Trib Rapture. Okay? So, he's saying, what Cameron is doing is he's saying that it's a new origin and that the doctrine of the pre-tribulation rapture first was taught by a tongue-speaking person in Edward Irving's church. And this is what he said. A watchword in the truth. Do you think it wise to exalt into a test of fellowship a doctrine so recklessly enunciated that does not have a single passage of Scripture beyond the question of a doubt upon which to rest its feet? That at such a questionable origin from the lips of a heretic and supported by the testimony of demons, and that was enforced by him and by them, then as it may be now, as the only means by which a sleeping church could be aroused to activity. So he is, listen, is he blasting these guys? Wow, he's going after them, and he's using the same argument that we already discussed. Again, the argument that the pre-tribulation rapture was first taught in Edward Irving's church in 1830 in a tongues meeting, and therefore the entire pre-tribulation rapture idea is of satanic, demonic origin because it originated in a tongues meeting in 1870. Now, again, we've gone over that, spent 3 or 4 hours in this class going over why that's not true. Okay? And again, I don't want to digress too far into things that we've already spent 4 hours on or we'll never get anywhere. But the bottom line here is this. This rift, is this becoming so severe that it's not ever going to be able to be fixed? Yeah. Okay. He is now charging Gabe Line, whatever, you know, listen, I'm not saying that Gabe Line and Schofield are above reproach here, okay? Because, you know, he is willfully disregarding his legal claim in what he's doing, okay? So you can, you know, that's not necessarily the best thing to do either, obviously. But the bottom line is, doctrinally speaking, are these two ever going to be able to come back together after this? Probably not. Not unless one is willing to totally, you know, admit that they were wrong and that the other one was right, which, as you know, very rarely ever happens. So, the result of this paper war between Our Hope and Watchword and Truth is that the Gabeline-Schofield party emerged from the struggle far stronger than their opposition. According to Sandine, this can be explained partly by the superior organizational and editorial skills of the pre-tribulationists and would be attributed in large part by the pre-tribulationists themselves and their better grasp of Scripture and the consequent blessing of God upon their party. So,
who's going to emerge here? And if you're going to assign a winner and a loser to this argument, who wins? Gabeline and Schofield emerge from this as the stronger group. So the pre-tribulationalist wing of premillennialism in the United States is going to emerge from this struggle as the stronger of the two groups. And they're going to remain that way for quite a while, moving on into the 20th century. Okay?
So it's important that you understand that the
combination then of Gabeline and Schofield are going to be the ones that are going to drive this thing forward after the Niagara Bible Conference fell apart.
Now, Gabeline provided the spark for the millenarian movement during the first two decades of the 20th century. Rather than withdrawing to lick his wounds, he led his followers in a vigorous campaign of expansion. In 1901, he rented Park Street Church in Boston. He goes right in. What Gabeline does is he rents a church in the hometown and base of Cameron's ministry and holds a series of meetings where they teach the pre-tribulation rapture right under Cameron's nose. So Gabeline is, when it says there in the notes that he goes on the offensive, not only does he go on the offensive as far as what he's teaching, but he goes right into the Cameron's home turf to do it. So Gabeline is sort of, he's not afraid of doing what he feels needs to be done. In 1901, he rented the Park Street Church in Boston, Cameron country, and held a 3-day conference for his supporters. A similar conference was held in May in New York City. In 1901, Gabeline and Schofield, with the financial support of some wealthy Plymouth Brethren, began the Seacliff Bible Conference on Long Island, which continued for 10 years. Gabeline heralded Seacliff as the rightful successor of Niagara. It was this group that planned the prophecy conferences at Chicago in 1914 and in New York in 1918. C.I. Schofield spoke at many of these conferences, as well as a roster of other speakers who appeared quite regularly. James M. Gray, Henry M. Parsons, F.C. Jennings, John James, and George L. Ulrich. The dispensationalists had won the day so completely that for the next 50 years, friend and foe alike largely identified dispensationalism with premillennialism. So these guys, under the leadership of these two men, the pre-trib faction of premillennialism in the United States is going to basically become so synonymous with pre-tribulationalism in this country that it becomes virtually common knowledge that if you are a pre-tribulationalist, if you are a premillennial, you are also dispensational. Now, are there any questions about any of that before we move on? Mike?
Well, I would just say that Our Hope magazine was a very popular magazine if we were living at that time.
Yeah.
It was much like the Berean Searchlight was under Stan. We saw a booklet that came to your home every month, and but it was subscription-driven, but it was very popular magazine.
And like I said before,
it's been a long time, too. It was the late 50s.
Yeah. And part of that is, at least allegedly, is because Schofield helped secure that mailing list from Brooks's magazine. But these two guys then are going to lead in the first two decades of the 20th century. These two guys are going to lead the premillennial charge, and dispensationalism is going to become synonymous with premillennialism in the United States. Now, as you know, and as we'll see over the next few weeks, eventually, Schofield publishes what? His reference Bible. When he publishes his reference Bible, and this doctrine and teaching gets written into the notes of the reference Bible, and the reference Bible sells into the millions of copies, you can see how this thing is going to unfold here, and how the influence of a dispensational approach is going to become popular in the United States. Now, when I say popular, I mean amongst people like you and I. The academic world and the denominational world never liked the Schofield Reference Bible, and we'll talk more about that later on. So, it was at the Seacliff Conference, though, in 1901, that Schofield first discussed with Gabelein an idea that had been growing in his mind for some time, an annotated version of the Bible. Now, this is Gabelein's testimony from his book, The History of the Schofield Reference Bible. He says, one night, about the middle of the week, Dr. Schofield suggested after the evening service that we take a stroll along the shore. It was a beautiful night. Our walk along the shore of the Sound lasted until midnight. For the first time, he mentioned the plan of producing a reference Bible and outlined the method he had in mind. He said he had thought of it for many years and had spoken to others about it, but had not received much encouragement. The scheme came to him in his early days of his ministry in Dallas, and later, during the balmy days of the Niagara conferences, he had submitted his desire to a number of brethren who all approved of it, but nothing came of it. He expressed the hope that the new beginning and this new testimony in Seacliff might open the way to bring about the publication of such a Bible with references and copious footnotes. So it's the testimony of Gabelein that at the 1901 Seacliff Conference, Schofield has his conversation with him, where he first mentions to him his desire to put out an annotated study Bible, and Gabelein is going to support the idea. The Bible which Schofield discussed with Gabelein that night is perhaps the most influential single publication in the millenarian and fundamentalist historiography. The Schofield Reference Bible combined an attractive format of typography, paragraphing, notes, and cross-references with the theology of Darbyite dispensationalism. This Schofield Reference Bible, and this is going to be the main focus of our discussion next week and for a few weeks, this is by far the single most influential document, published document, that comes out of this era in American church history as far as premillennialism, dispensationalism, and fundamentalism are concerned. Okay? The impact of it should not be underestimated, and it's hard to overstate the impact that the publication of the Schofield Reference Bible has upon American premillennialism and fundamentalism. In 1902, the men who were backing the Seacliff Conference decided to make the finances available for the publication of the Reference Bible. So the decision to move forward is made roughly in 1902. Now, there are other things that are going to have to be worked out as time moves forward, like who's going to publish it and other things that would go, that you would sort of assume would be involved in putting out something as big a project as this would be. But the fundamental decision to move forward with it is made in 1902. It is published and released by Oxford University Press in New York City in 1909. So the decision is made to move forward in 1902. The Bible, the first edition of the Bible, is going to be put out in 1909. Now, before we start talking about who Schofield was himself, does anybody have any questions about any of that?
Is the Bible still being printed and made today, or did they stop doing that?
I believe it's still being printed.
Because my Bible's dated back like 10 years it was printed. So.
You mean the last time the copyright was renewed?
It says that this was printed in such year. Yeah.
Mine says that it was printed under the 1996 copyright renewal. Okay. I'm assuming most, if anybody has one in here, that's probably the case, unless you have an older one. So the publication, again, the decision to produce it is made in roughly 1902. It's printed, the first edition is printed in 1909. Now, are there any other questions regarding that chronology before we start talking about Schofield himself? Now, before we go any further, a book that is as influential as the Schofield Reference Bible was, should you expect that everybody is just going to accept it? No. So, both the Reference Bible itself and its primary editor, C.I. Schofield, have been the target of attacks by people who don't like dispensational theology. Okay? Now, in 2009, so at the 100, commemorating the 100 year anniversary of the publication of the Reference Bible, Todd R. Mangum and Mark S. Sweetum put out this book, The Schofield Reference Bible, Its History and Impact on the Evangelical Church. So what they do in this book is they go through and discuss Schofield, the roots of the theology of the Schofield Reference Bible, the dispensational scheme presented by Schofield in the Reference Bible, and then the impact of the Reference Bible both in Great Britain and here in the United States, as well as the legacy of the Reference Bible. In my estimation, having read at least four books about this in addition to this one, if I were going to recommend you read one book about Schofield and the Reference Bible, I think this one is the most fair-minded, myself. Okay, and I'll explain a little bit about that here as we go through this. In 2009, in commemoration of the 100-year anniversary of the Schofield Reference Bible, R. Todd Mangum and Mark Sweetum wrote The Schofield Bible, Its History and Impact on the Evangelical Church. According to Mangum and Sweetum, evaluating Schofield's life story presents a fascinating plot line, complete with mystery, twists and turns, shameful failures, and glorious triumphs. His life presents both bursts of radiant, regenerative light and shadows that conceal the whole story to this day. All right. Now, it's important that you understand. Does everybody know what the word historiography means? Historiography is the study of the history that's been written. It's kind of a little bit of an obscure concept. But it's basically, well, I'll just explain it by reading this point. Early biographies of Schofield kept the controversial portions of his life off the record. So if you grabbed an early biography, they're not going to talk to you about anything that Schofield might have done. that would have been controversial. They just leave it out. Okay? Whether by design or by intended consequence, an image with the Christian public was established that suggested that the one responsible for the notes of the Scofield Reference Bible was in a class of saintliness approaching that of the Bible's main subject. Okay? So there is they do not include anything about Scofield in these early biographies that may be damaging to Scofield, and by connection there, damaging to the reference Bible. So a few of these are The Life Story of C.I. Scofield by Trumbull, that was 1920. The History of the Scofield Reference Bible by Arnold Gabelein, 1943. The Story of the Scofield Reference Bible by his son, Frank Gabelein, in 1959. And then a series of published things in the Sunday School Times, What I Learned from Dr. Scofield by Lewis Berry Schaefer. All right? Now, in the mid-1980s, a Scofield detractor named Joseph Canfield self-published a study of Scofield's life, The Incredible Scofield and His Book, with the goal of unearthing secrets and bringing the dirt to the surface. Notable for the extensiveness of its research, its approach is like that of a private investigator charged with collecting evidence against a felon. No rumor is deemed unworthy for consideration as potential fact, and no motive of Scofield's heart deemed incapable of being impugned. So in the mid-1980s, Canfield's going to write a book that is going to seek to excoriate Scofield. Okay? So we have a problem here when it comes to Scofield. Does anybody care to guess what it is? The problem... Yeah, Mike, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, he had a little drinking problem before he was saved, and his divorce.
Yeah, those are two of the what are going to be two of the big issues.
Plus, he was in prison.
Yeah, but my point is this: when it comes to the written literature about Scofield, in my opinion, largely until this book is published in 2009, you either have the friends of Scofield writing about him and not telling you anything about what he may have done that would have been not good, if you know what I'm saying. And then you have this other guy who hates Scofield, who does not like dispensational theology, writing a book seeking to just go into any little nook, cranny, and facet of his life and pull out anything that he can use to discredit him. Alright? So there was not a very... The historiography of the works that were out there on Scofield were not very, you know, they were very polarized. You had his friends on one hand, you had his enemy on the other hand, and there was nothing sort of in the middle that acknowledged, yeah, Scofield did some things that he shouldn't have done, but didn't necessarily seek to disparage everything that he did after he got saved. So, I want to talk a little bit about this stuff here. So point number two on page four. The result of all this is that the facts of Scofield's life have today become politicized, particularly among those in opposition to Scofield's theological views. Rumors continue to swirl, especially via the internet, about infidelities, crimes, and misdemeanors in which Scofield is alleged to have fallen into. Others have objected to this largely posthumous defamation of his character and have sought to restore his image and spirit. The work of Mangum and Sweetum, that's this one right here, attempts to present a fair-minded evaluation of Scofield's life and ministry that does not defend or defame his life and ministry. Scofield was born August 19, 1843, in Leawanau County, Michigan, interestingly enough, the youngest of seven children. After his mother died, unable to recover from his birth, his father remarried, resulting in Scofield being raised by a stepmother. Little is known about his early life and education. Scofield reappears on the historical record in 1860 in Lebanon, Tennessee, in the home of his sister, Laura, and her husband. He enlisted in the Confederate Army on May 20, 1861, still being a minor. He falsified his enlistment papers by claiming he had been 20 years of age. He fought for the Confederacy on the Eastern Front at Richmond until he requested a release in 1862. He claimed to be an alien, having resided in Michigan, and to have falsified his enlistment qualifications. Alright, so, mark number one against Schofield, he is a known what? Liar. He lied to get into the Confederate Army, and then he lied, in a sense, to get out of the Confederate Army. Okay? So anybody seeking to disparage and discredit Schofield is going to point to this as a character flaw and say, he was a liar once, and he's always what? He's always been a liar. Okay? Schofield next appears in the record in St. Louis in 1865. Another sister, and I'm going to say this, Emmeline, is that right? Mm-hmm. Emmeline had married Sylvester Papin, of a French family prominent in the world's fur market. Papin was president of the St. Louis Board of Assessors. Schofield found employment in his brother-in-law's work, and in advancing among the city's social elite, met, how do you say this, Laurentine? Laurentine Curie. They married on September 21st, 1866. Sometime after this, Schofield moved his family to Atchison, Kansas, where he entered a career in politics and was elected in 1871 as a representative to the lower house of the Kansas legislature. In 1873, he was appointed by President Grant to the office of district attorney for the District of Kansas. He resigned within 6 months under suspicion of misuse of his office for personal gain. His wife gained a legal separation from her husband in 1877. The marriage dissolved, though the divorce did not become legal for 7 more years, which would have been 1883. After separating from his wife in 1871, Schofield returned to St. Louis, leaving his wife and children behind, and appears to have sunk into a life of thievery and drunkenness. So, Schofield, the nature of the political improprieties is not clear, okay? Most people suspect some type of graft or bribery that he was involved in for personal gain while he was a political official in the state of Kansas. After that, he goes back to St. Louis, and he leaves his wife and his children in Kansas. All right, and he's separated from them. He is later officially divorced from his wife after about 7 years in 1883. Okay? He appears to have been arrested and some other things. Top of page 5. In 1879, perhaps attending a crusade led by D.L. Moody, Schofield trusted that Jesus Christ died for his sins. So this is Schofield's conversion is after the mess that happened in Kansas, and he is now living estranged from his wife in St. Louis in 1879. In 1879, perhaps attending a crusade, I already read that, he trusted Christ. Schofield claimed that he never touched a drop of alcohol after that day. There's much evidence to suggest that he was indeed a changed man. However, he never reconciled with his wife or his children. His wife and children were apparently assisted by well-to-do family members, but as far as Schofield's Christian testimony was concerned, they remained to his dying day a skeleton in his closet. Upon his conversion, Schofield determined to use his analytical and oratory skills for Christian service. Soon, Dr. James Hall Brooks, pastor of the Washington and Compton Avenue Presbyterian Church in St. Louis, Missouri, was personally discipling Schofield in Brooks' own home. So there's the connection here between Schofield and Brooks. When Schofield gets saved, later in life, he immediately begins to be mentored by Brooks. Brooks, as you recall, or maybe if you didn't know, Brooks was a dispensationalist who had John Nelson Darby in his church teach from his pulpit and his podium when Darby visited the United States. Okay? So there's a direct connection. Schofield is connected directly to Darby through Brooks. Darby knew Brooks. Brooks mentors Schofield after Schofield gets saved. Any questions about any of this so far? Schofield proved himself to be capable and eager to join the work of Christian service, willing to carry signs or hand out pamphlets, and also adapted at public speaking. He became a key leader and popular preacher in the local YMCA. It was not long until his leadership and preaching gifts were sought after for pastoral service. He was licensed to preach by the St. Louis Administration of Congregational Churches in 1880. With the organization, he planted a church, Hyde Park Congregational Church of North St. Louis, and became the founding pastor. The Council of Congregational Ministers and Churches, which was the body officially charged with determining Schofield's fitness for ministry, deemed all the past events of his life covered by the blood of Christ and officially ordained him for pastoral ministry. So when Schofield appears before this board of people that are going to ordain him, according to my knowledge, from what I can gather, he lays out to them, you know, the whole rotten story of everything that he's done, and the ordination board says, well, those things happened before you were saved. You are now saved. You've turned the corner and so on. You're not drinking anymore, blah, blah, blah. We're going to ordain you for the ministry, is apparently how it went. So, in 1882, Schofield accepted a call to a mission church of the denomination in Dallas, where he was ordained in 1883. A small work grew rapidly. Within the decade, the church reached a membership of over 400 from the 14 when he first arrived. A large church was erected in 1889. In 1884, he married a member of his congregation, Hetty Van Wark. And in 1887, he began to appear regularly in the Bible conferences, such as Northfield and Niagara conferences, recognized for his teaching abilities. In 1888, he published an immensely popular Rightly Dividing the Word of Truth, an explanation of dispensational, pre-tribulational, and premillennial approach to interpreting Scripture. In addition, around this time, Schofield began publishing a Bible correspondence course that enrolled over 10,000 people. In 1914, these courses became part of the curriculum offered by Moody Bible Institute. Moreover, the notes from these courses also served as the basis for the notes in the Schofield Reference Bible. So, all this stuff about his lying for entrance into the Confederate Army, his lying for being, discharged, his political chicanery, whatever that was in Kansas, his estrangement and later divorce from his wife. All of these things in the early biographies of Schofield are totally ignored. Okay? Then Canfield comes along in the middle of the 1980s and writes his book, bringing all this stuff to the surface and trying to discredit everything that Schofield ever did and cast doubt and disparagement upon the Schofield Reference Bible and create the perception, or at least create doubt in people's minds whether or not Schofield was really even qualified for the ministry and whether or not he should be doing any of these things that he later did, including all the things that we just read. The pastorates that he served under, the articles that he's writing, the correspondence study courses, the fact that those are later included in the curriculum at Moody Bible Institute, all these things are now, Canfield's purpose is to create doubt in everybody's mind about Schofield. So, it's important, I think, that we at least acknowledge that Schofield had these things in his past, if we're going to be honest about it. Now, one note, it is interesting to me, personally, that the Schofield notes got included in the curriculum at Moody Bible Institute. Because if you look at where Moody Bible Institute's at now, compared to where they were, that they would have accepted those notes into the curriculum, it's pretty frightening about how fast the decline was. And the reason for that, in my opinion, one of the reasons for that happening there, with those notes being included in the curriculum, is that if you have a Schofield Reference Bible, if you look at the title page, where it lists the editors, you'll see that James Gray is listed as one of the consulting editors. James Gray was one of Schofield's friends, along with Gabe Line, and he is the president of Moody Bible Institute. So, when he's the president of the Moody Bible Institute, he takes Scofield's notes and includes them within the curriculum of Moody Bible Institute. And oh, by the way, one last thing that I'll mention about Mr. James Gray, and we'll study it probably later on, is that Mr. Gray, in his commentary, says that the Great Commission is not for the church. So, he is a very dispensationally minded individual. He wasn't right about everything, but these guys are committed to this approach to Scripture. So, as if all, last point now on page 5. As if all this were not enough, Scofield directed the Southwestern School of the Bible in Dallas and was president of the Board of Trustees of the denomination's Lake Charles College in Lake Charles, Louisiana. In 1918, he founded the Central American Mission, having been inspired by J. Hudson Taylor the previous year at the Niagara Bible Conference. This is the same year he started the correspondence. Page 6, in 1895, Scofield was invited to become pastor of Moody's Home Church, the Trinitarian Congregational Church in Northfield, Massachusetts. When Moody died 4 years later, Scofield presided over the funeral. When D.L. Moody dies, the officiating pastor at Moody's funeral is C.I. Scofield. Okay? In the Scofield Bible, Mangum and Sweetum discuss some of the more unsavory aspects of Scofield's life under the following headings. Should Scofield's divorce have disqualified him from the ministry he undertook? Second, was Scofield simply a fraud? Time and space will simply not permit a detailed discussion of this lengthy section of their book. Interested parties are encouraged to seek out their own copy of the book. We will, however, consider a few summary points about these matters. All right? It's too much in here for me to go into every gory detail, so I'm just going to try to summarize for you, give you the gist of a couple things you need to be aware of. Especially within the fundamentalist wing of American Christianity, both this divorce and his struggle with alcoholism held potential for ruining Scofield's reputation and his entire ministry if they had been widely known. Okay? So, the friends of Scofield that don't report these things do not do it for a reason. And the reason they're not reporting it is because they are afraid that if they do, the fact that he was divorced and the fact that he struggled with alcoholism would immediately disqualify him in the minds of a lot of these people and that they would no longer give him any type of hearing. So they just don't discuss it. Okay? There were occasions, even during his lifetime, when rumors of Scofield's past life would surface and cause him grief. After one Bible conference, having heard Scofield share his testimony about Christ delivering him from alcoholism, D.L. Moody counseled him strongly against sharing such aspects of his past life with the public. There is simply no question that Scofield and certain of his close friends did conceal from the record the fact that Scofield had been divorced and had an ex-wife and children from a previous marriage. They did not want the public by at large to know about it because they feared the repercussions. Now you got to understand, whether it's right or wrong, are these fundamentalists extremely conservative? So the fact that he'd been divorced and struggled with alcohol would have been a deal killer for a lot of them if they'd known about it. So there appears to be that Scofield is given direct counsel not to discuss it, not to mention it, and not to bring it up. Not only by Moody, but by others possibly as well. Canfield contends that the character flaws in Scofield's failed marriage are part of a pattern of dishonesty both before and after his alleged conversion. So Canfield even calls his conversion alleged. He doesn't even necessarily believe that he ever trusted Christ. According to Canfield, Scofield is guilty of perpetrating instances of fraud and deception throughout his life. Three episodes from Scofield's life are submitted by Canfield as proof that Scofield was a fraud. It's important to note that only one of these events happened after Scofield's 1879 conversion. So, according to Canfield, these areas are, number one, as I already said to you, his alleged discrepancies and deceit concerning Schofield's military service in the Confederate Army. Alright? The fact that Schofield lied about his age on his enlistment papers is beyond dispute. No, you can't. It's a record, it's a historical record. You cannot dispute the fact that he lied about his age when he went to enlist in the Confederate Army. Second, Schofield's time as a lawyer and politician. Kansas politics seems to have been a hotbed of graft and corruption. And Schofield seems to have been tainted by it to some extent. The exact nature of the political scandal that Schofield found himself in, no one knows for sure. That Schofield engaged in activities of questionable ethics once the scandal broke out seems clear. Being removed from office put him in a desperate situation, not least of all financially. At one point, he used the name of his client, John Ingalls, to secure funds for himself. While Ingalls never pressed charges, this maneuver cost Schofield his job and ended his legal career in the state of Kansas, the one state which he was fully licensed to practice law. And the final episode that Canfield uses to convict Schofield of being a fraud centers on his credentials. Sometime in the early 1890s, Schofield began using the title Reverend C.I. Schofield, D.D., or Doctor of Divinity. The D.D. refers to an honorary degree of Doctor of Divinity. What is mysterious about this fact is that no one, including Mangum and Sweetum, have been able to locate any record of what academic institution awarded this honorary degree to Schofield. Canfield jumps to the most slanderous conclusion possible by arguing that Schofield simply conferred it upon himself. So, we don't know what institution conferred upon Schofield an honorary doctor of divinity. Canfield uses the lack of information about that as a means, though, to say, to jump to the most slanderous possible conclusion that Schofield just gave it to himself. Now, I will say this. We just read about two or three institutions of higher learning that Schofield was either on the board of or a part of. So it's highly possible that any one of those institutions could have conferred upon him an honorary doctorate degree. What is a bit puzzling, though, is why those schools don't have any record of having done so. So these are sort of the facts, and we'll get the last point, and then we have time for a few questions. It is certainly beyond question that his own accounts of his life did not contain the whole truth. Some will find this understandable, others devious. Schofield was a sinner, as he claimed. What is probably more remarkable is that he was redeemed relatively late in life, at age 36, and went on to give such notable Christian service till the end of his life. Someone once said, God can draw a straight line with a crooked stick. Okay? How straight was the line drawn through the life of Schofield, and how crooked the stick of Schofield the man, are points that remain in dispute. But that the life and work of Schofield manifest the truth of this proverb, no one can really dispute. Okay? So, any questions, comments, reactions, thoughts about this? Frank?
Just remind you a little bit of...
Fred, I mean, sorry.
I say, it reminds you a little bit about the Apostle Paul. He was kind of stumbled before he was saved.
Yeah, pretty much. Mike and then Daryl.
I'm just amazed that he's saved in 1879 and 1880. A year later, he's being ordained by the Congregationalists. Or an extremely capable, influential, well-known person.
Well, he apparently was able to use his lawyer skills and apply them to ministry in such a way that gained him. Well, I think that the key point there is this. There's two skills that I think a lawyer would benefit from. Number one, the study skills and the ability to process and organize the information. And number two, if he has experience arguing cases in open court, he's probably going to be a fairly good public speaker and be able to present clear sermons to an audience and they'll understand. So I think those are probably two of the things that led him to advance quite rapidly. Daryl?
Maybe I had stepped out of the room for a minute, but it says in that last note on 5, it says in 1980 he found it, so that's not correct. Right?
Where?
No,
that's a misprint. It should be 1880. It should be 1880. Yeah, it's 1880.
Can you blame Schofield for any of the stuff he did in the past? Because I don't think I could blame him at all. Like, everyone has their dirt, but he changed his whole entire life.
I think, here's what I'll answer that. I think we got to be honest about who Schofield was. Just like I think we should be honest about who we are. I mean, we all have stuff that we don't want people in this room to know about us, I would imagine. You know, things that we've done and, you know, things that we'd be embarrassed if everybody knew. So I think there's two things I would say to that. Number one, I think it's wrong to portray him as being a saint, like he never did anything. But I also think it's wrong to jump to the other conclusion where you disqualify everything he ever did because he did some things that he shouldn't have. So, you know, I think Fred's analogy of the Apostle Paul is quite fitting for, you know, who Schofield was. Here's a guy that was clearly troubled, was clearly involved in many things that he should not have been in, illegal activities and so on and so forth. He gets saved and it totally changes the course of the rest of his life. So I don't tend to say, wow, I'm going to get rid of my Schofield reference Bible and I'm going to get rid of everything that he ever wrote and I'm not going to do that because I think that's not in line with grace either, really, to be honest. Ronnie?
I think the error was made by the biographer.
I agree.
Because Luke included the dirt about Paul.
Yeah, if there's any fault, it may even be that he was counseled to just not say anything. Because I think that the force of his testimony could have been increased if he had just told people the whole story. So, you may be right that the real issue is not with Schofield himself, but with the people that wrote about him.
I'm just a firm believer, and it's not just past that defines you, but you're doing it daily.
Any other questions or comments?
Well, yeah. The last real issue would have been then the last thing of Paul when he claimed he had his doctor's degree, right, if it was self-made up.
But that can't be proven one way or the other. It cannot be proven beyond doubt that he made it up, and it cannot be proven, and we can't prove who conferred it upon him. But he was certainly friends with and involved with enough people that were involved with institutions of higher learning within premillennial fundamentalism that could have bestowed upon him that degree. I mean, it's not like he was running with a circle of friends, as it were, that were not involved with that stuff. So any one of them could have done it.
That was in my time. Any president of a college, you could set right down.
Right.
He wants to self-say, I'll give you a doctorate degree, so I'll help you out here.
Because if you look at the title page of the reference Bible, his name is listed as Reverend C.I. Schofield, D.D. I personally feel that if he did confer it upon himself, that's like the stupidest thing you can do, because eventually somebody's going to find out that you're masquerading as a doctor of divinity when you don't have... I just have a hard time believing that he would do that. Maybe he did, I don't know, but I think it's not reasonable that he would have. Okay, Mike?
I think it's unfair to make a big deal about his lying about going into the army. The Civil War was like no other war you ever had. You could buy yourself out of the conscription if you had the money, and then no one cared if you lied about your age, they just took you.
And
I think they're taking it out of context a little bit.
And Mangum and Sweeta make that point. They make the point that to chastise, that in Canfield's chastising him about that, he probably would have had to chastise scores of other people that did things, you know, ministry-related things, for similar reasons. And so they point that out. That's why I personally feel that if you're going to read a book about Schofield, you should just get this one, because I think it's the most fair book. I'll just put it that way.
Only the ones from the UP.
Alright, well, we need to quit. So next week and moving forward, we're going to actually start discussing the reference Bible itself.
Hey, Brian. I'd love to do the introduction over again.
Huh? How far?
Just
to
what you
were
saying.
Yeah, but just don't worry about it. Yes. Please.